This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the Natural Sciences Museum in downtown Raleigh. I'm Frank Stachow. So when I say the word dinosaur, do you think of a large skeleton in a museum, or do you picture an actual massive breathing moving creature? Well, the new exhibit here at the Museum of Natural Sciences looks at the biology of dinosaurs as living organisms. The World's Largest Dinosaurs exhibit offers a new lens for looking into this old supersized creature. How do they move? How do they breathe? And beyond that, what do dinosaurs have to do with modern life? Several paleontologists join me today to talk about what we have learned and what we can learn about the current ecosystem from examining the way dinosaurs lived and died. Lindsay Zano is Director of Paleontology and Geology Research Lab here at the museum. Lindsay, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank.
Also with us, Mary Schweitzer, a curator of the vertebrate paleontology at the museum, and a professor of biology at North Carolina State. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you.
Also, Vince Schneider is curator of paleontology here at the museum. Hi, Vince.
Thank you.
So, Lindsay, talk about the exhibit. First of all, how is this different from other dinosaur exhibits, or is it?
Oh, it certainly is. Most dinosaur exhibits you see in a museum are just a bunch of static skeletons, and you're just looking at the internal structure of the animal. The exhibit that we have right now is designed to take you into what paleontology is largely about today, which is figuring out the life of these animals, how they breathed, how they moved, how they grew up from babies to adults.
And that's a lot of when you think about the size of these animals in particular, that is a lot to think about. Mary, your research looks at some of the biomechanics of these creatures, right? Tell us more about that and your work in Argentina.
Well, in Argentina, we worked for four field seasons on one of the largest dinosaur nesting grounds that has been found. And that it was for a particular type of sauropod dinosaur called the Titanosaur. So they weren't the biggest of the sauropods, but they were pretty massive. And
like how massive?
I don't remember off the top of my head.
Is there one of them that's kind of like 14 about, times the size of an
yeah,
elephant?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That would be an average.
That's a big animal.
You take 14 elephants and stack them on top of each other and you get a sauropod roughly.
Right.
But yeah, these guys had returned to the nest. They showed site fidelity and the nesting ground was 10 miles laterally extensive with nests about every 10, 15 feet, 25 eggs per nest. So they were pretty healthy in terms of reproduction.
Therein lies a number of mysteries, right? The
yes.
fact that these nests were so close together relatively, and you have some fairly large animals, so that should raise questions about how it was they got around without busting their own eggs, right?
Well, and some people propose that this particular kind of dinosaur didn't show any kind of parental care, or just basically like a turtle laid their eggs and then left. It still poses some problems, and it's a pretty interesting sight for many reasons.
The eggs themselves relatively small given the size of the creature?
Relative to the adult size of the creature, yes. The eggs are bigger than an ostrich egg, but smaller than the giant elephant bird egg. And so these were the most massive animals on the planet, and they started out smaller than some birds, extinct birds that we had.
Any sense of sort of their growth rate? How long did they live, and how long did it take them to get to full size?
One of the ways that we can tell how fast an animal grew is because it laid down rest lines where the bones stopped growing, usually seasonally or annually. And so it's kind of like counting the rings on a tree, only more complicated because some of them are resorbed. But you can kind of count them and get a rough estimate of how old they were when they died. And so by looking at that, plus the type of bone that was laid down, we can say that sauropod dinosaurs grew really fast. Some researchers say that they went from a hatchling to an adult in as little as 10 years.
Wow. And they started out coming out of an ostrich-sized egg, not the size of an ostrich, but the size of an ostrich egg.
Right.
And they get to something 14 times the size of a dinosaur in 10 years. Do they eat a lot?
Well, we weren't around to watch them. But what's really interesting is they all ate plants.
Yeah.
And plant diets don't support that kind of metabolism today. Well, huh. I mean, elephants eat plants, but they don't grow that fast.
Right.
So
they're only 1/14 the size.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a lot of mysteries about the sauropod dinosaurs that are featured in the exhibit here. Lots and lots of mysteries. In fact, to me, they're really, really cool animals to study, and a lot of questions that I have about them probably will never be answered.
Any guesses about how they were able to derive the nutrition, the nutrients they needed from a diet that suggests to us that it just couldn't be done?
Well, some things would be the plants were more nutritious to start with, because most of the plants that were around when they were around were extinct. They did have accessory structures. Their teeth, in some cases, weren't all that strong or that well-rooted, but they, a lot of them show some signs. It's equivocal whether they had stomach stones to help with digestion or not.
So like they may have gotten more out of their food than
they may have had a completely different gut fauna, microbes in the gut that processed more efficiently. So there's a lot of, and they probably ate pretty much continually without stopping. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, what else was there to do back then? Vince, in fact, talking about back then, your work actually looks at a period before this period that we're looking at, or Mary's work in Argentina. Tell us about when that was and what your work focuses on.
Okay, my work focuses on the Triassic period here in North Carolina and also in Arizona. We're looking at sediments that were basically 220 to 230 million years ago laid down. And this was at a time when all the continents were together as one supercontinent called Pangaea. And what we're finding is at the end of the Paleozoic, there was a major extinction event. 95% of all species of animals disappeared, most of those being marine animals. But even in the terrestrial range, there was enough extinctions that happened that you had lots of niches sort of empty.
This is before the great dinosaur extinction.
Before the great dinosaur extinction. And because all these niches were empty, all these habitats, you were able to get really evolution kicked into high gear. And we get all evolution basically went rampant. And we get our first dinosaurs evolving. We get our first crocodilians evolving. We get our first pterosaurs evolving, ichthyosaurs, turtles.
Evolving from what? So what was it that had
from the things like turtles are still a mystery where they came from.
Yeah.
We're not sure what animal particularly they evolved from. And the archosaurs came from earlier reptiles, and they evolved. We also, before we had mammals, we had basically pre-mammals, things like cynodonts and dicynodonts, both of which we find in the fossil record in North Carolina. Mm.
You do work in Arizona and North Carolina, right?
That's correct.
How do they compare? What do you find? What are the differences in those two sites or areas?
Before we go into differences, let's go into similarities. Most of the fauna is very similar. We have a large abundance of these early crocodilian-like animals, things like phytosaurs, which were aquatic crocodilian-like, almost like a gavial with a small snout, but instead of the nostrils being on the tip of the snout, as they are in alligators today, they were back over by the eyes. Mm. You also had little armored crocodilians that were called aetosaurs, and they were of various sizes from a few feet to 10, 20 feet, you know. Those were all and we're getting examples of these both in North Carolina and in the Arizona faunas. And then we get a number of the pre-mammals. In the Arizona site, we get a big sort of a hog size or bigger than a hog sized animal called Placerius, and we get that animal here also in North Carolina. The little cynodonts we get in North Carolina very abundantly, but are not found very commonly in Arizona.
And were these, I assume that because things are moving around a lot, the continents are shifting, breaking apart, I'm assuming that the relative position of North Carolina to Arizona was roughly the same at that time?
Roughly the same. Yeah. If you really want to look at, and I've not really done this in my research, but if you want to look at very similar faunas to North Carolina, you go basically to Africa, which was connected to North Carolina. So the fauna, Triassic faunas in Morocco are very similar to North Carolina.
Lindsay, chronologically, your field of work comes after Vince's. Tell us about your work in Utah.
Yeah, well, extinction is a common theme for paleontological research. It's one of the things we can really contribute some interesting data to. And we're actually working in a time period when sauropods, these giant terrestrial animals, went extinct in North America. So they succumbed to environmental change or interactions with other species, and we're interested to know why that happened and where this whole new dinosaur fauna came from.
So you're looking at the period, and again, we're not talking about what happened 65 million years ago. We're talking about the extinction that preceded that, right? Was it a serial extinction, or did it seem to be something that happened in the course of, I don't know, what period of time did we lose this 95% of species?
Well, so there are several major mass extinctions that we know of from the fossil record. So the one that Vince referenced, where 95% of life goes extinct, right? That's almost unimaginable and a catastrophic event. Scientists today postulate we're in what we call the sixth mass extinction. In other words, the rate of species disappearing is equivalent to a mass extinction rate. But there's also smaller extinctions that happen on a local level that can give us a lot of ideas to how animals interact. And our field work is focusing on one smaller extinction event in the Cretaceous period. But it's very notable in that these giant sauropods that were really characteristic of North America that we all sort of know and love and think about all the time disappeared here and were replaced by other kinds of plant-eating dinosaurs at the time.
Well, I do need to get back to that other extinction, 95% of life on the planet gone. Do we know why? What was going on? What contributed to that?
Well, there's always a lot of theories, a lot of different types of evidence, extraterrestrial impacts, volcanism, and a lot of times these are correlated to problems with ocean chemistry, where lots of oceanic life dies off. And one of the things we're trying to understand are how ecosystems collapse and what it takes. How much extinction can an ecosystem take before the whole thing sort of crumbles out?
I see. So at the cascade effect or this hockey stick effect where things are puttering along at a certain kind of predictable rate and then a sharp curve in extinction.
And,
so, yeah, go ahead, Vince.
And things like, you know, the crater that you find with the mass extinction at 65 million years old get more difficult to actually find in the geologic record of the planet if you go back 250 million years because they've had all that erosion and change of geography.
Yeah, and that crater, I mean, and I'm going to muddle through this. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but the idea of the asteroid or something striking the Earth sends up a lot of dust, perhaps triggers a lot of volcanic activity, puts a lot of dust in the air, reduces the amount of sunlight, has an impact on plant life, plankton life, and therefore, you know, animals that depended on copious amounts of food are suddenly stuck, and you could have a mass extinction. If that explains what happened 65 million years ago, as you say, it's harder to get the record of that if you go back 227 million years because everything's eroded. I can't find the crater. So, Lindsay, talk about the extinctions that you're looking at, these animals that we've come to know and love in North America. They were not part of a mass extinction. There was some sort of local dynamic. Do we know what was going on?
Well, it's an interesting model system, right? With our modern ecosystems, we're all very concerned about increasing global temperature, hothouse world, and increasing sea level rise. And what we're looking at is an actual model system in the Cretaceous when we saw global temperature increasing, just as we do now, and global sea level rise sort of impacting these areas. And so we're trying to figure out how the dinosaur ecosystems were affected by the same conditions that we're seeing now, only on a much longer time scale.
When you think about it, I mean, you heard our first segment, we're talking about sea level rise, just the complexity of trying to predict, then what to do about those predictions, the dynamics of knowing as humans we could intervene and change the rate of process, how complicated it is when all the evidence is right in front of us. Your work must be, you know, sort of quintuply difficult if you're trying to figure out all of those dynamics, how they played together. And there's nobody around to, you know, kind of tell you how it was going.
Well, in a way, but we're not trying to predict. We actually have the data at hand. So we're really just trying to figure out what the actual data tells us. And then we can hopefully contribute something to those predictions that's based on reality of what has happened on life on the planet in the past.
Of course, the scary thing for a paleontologist is you don't know what you don't know. You don't know how many species are out there that could have contributed to this that you haven't even discovered yet. The rate of discovery is increasing. Is that right? For the dinosaur discovery, species discovery is increasing. What accounts for that, do you think? Just
probably
more people
Jurassic
looking?
Park.
Yeah. Okay. More.
Now, there are whole new generations of paleontologists. It's becoming much more of an integrated science that fits in with things that we've classically done in biology. Mary's work, for example, is really tied to cellular and chemicals. So paleo is finding a way to sort of reach out into a lot of different disciplines and really expand.
And so what? And you have already uncovered a couple of species just in the last couple of years, right?
Yeah, this area that we're working in is a whole new window into dinosaur evolution. Pretty much everything we're finding is new to science, which is really exciting. We have four new dinosaurs, one we named in 2013, and three more in the pipeline that will be rolling out over the years. So lots of new information that we can use to try and answer this question.
Ooh, can you tell us about the new ones?
Oh, we've got – well, one of the interesting things about this particular time period is everything is huge. Since we're on the huge topic today, everything is really big, and we'd sure like to know why. We have some new feathered dinosaurs that are gigantic, some of the biggest that we found anywhere in the world, some new plant eaters as well.
Speaking of feathered – so I just learned today that – I mean, we know that birds, you know, were kind of a crossover. Birds were around in this period with the dinosaurs. They share time and space. Birds are dinosaurs? Are you telling me birds are dinosaurs?
Yes, living, breathing dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are survivors. They actually, dinosaurs, there are more dinosaurian species on the planet today than there are mammals, lizards, snakes, reptiles. I mean, dinosaurs are still the most successful group of terrestrial vertebrates we have on the planet today. We just don't acknowledge that very often.
No, I have to change my intro, which said 65 million years ago was the last dinosaur, and now you're saying, no, they're flying over my head every minute. This is pretty interesting stuff. But again, if we look at – a question I have is why at that point when we saw this – okay, 95% of the species leave the planet, lots of niches, lots of space for people to grow. Why didn't – I'm going to just pose the question. You can guess and even lie to me if you want. Why didn't nature make big animals to begin with? I mean, these niches, if you talk about 95% extinction, there was a time when there was zero life on the planet. So why didn't it go right to big, giant reptiles? Anybody have a guess? Well, make something up.
How long do you have?
Well, you're looking at this thing from the molecular level, so maybe there's something about the biology of bigness and metabolism that would be part of this answer. I don't know.
Well, when you think in terms of biomass and in terms of diversity, still the most speciose, incredibly diverse, widely distributed organisms on the planet are microbes, and they're single-celled. And so life starts simple and gets more complex. Life started single-celled, and it took a long, long time for life to learn how to be multicellular. So once you learn how to be multicellular, then you can grow. And we don't really know the constraints on – I mean, that's one of the interesting things about studying dinosaurs that I think is really cool is we have in dinosaurs the smallest terrestrial organism, terrestrial vertebrate, and the largest. All within dinosaurs. So we kind of bookend what is possible for vertebrate life in terms of metabolism, growth rates, biomechanics, mass. I mean, you think about how hard it is on your knees to walk around for 60 years on a hard surface, especially if you carry a little extra weight. Think about what a dinosaur felt like.
Did they sleep standing up? They had to. It'd take too much energy to get up again.
I was not there.
You weren't
to watch.
There. You weren't there. Well, I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad this exhibit is here. It's wonderful stuff. Mary Schweitzer, a biology professor at North Carolina State and curator of vertebrate paleontology here at the museum. Lindsay Zano is director of the Paleontology and Geology Research Lab at the museum. Vince Schneider, curator of paleontology here at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thanks for having us.
Just ahead, a one-man show that wrestles with a long-running conflict. Stay with us on The State of Things.